We are here with
Mick Gunderson.
Great. And Mick is going to talk to us today about...
I'm going to be talking to you about the whole idea of rethinking how we look at response intervals in EMS.
Cool.
Let me give you a little bit of background so you can put my comments in a little bit of context. I've been involved in EMS for my entire career, starting back in the mid-70s. Worked a lot out in the field, got very involved with research and academics. For the last 15 years or so of my career, I've been doing EMS systems consulting, where I get called in by a city or a county typically, where the EMS system is dealing with some difficult issues, and I come in as a consultant to help them try to change the design of their system to make it perform better. One of the issues that I frequently have to deal with is the whole notion of where should the EMS response time target be set. I call that the target response interval. And also, let me clarify a term here. People often refer to response times, and I very purposely use the term response interval, because a time is a particular point in time, and what we're talking about really is the amount of time that passes between two events, which is really more appropriately called an interval. So that's why I'm using the term response intervals, even though you might typically hear it referred to as a response time. So indulge that pet peeve of mine, if you will, in terms of the terminology. So anyway, if we have a system and we're reconsidering how we're going to design that system to perform, one of the big issues you have to grapple with is how soon do people need to get there? How soon do interventions need to be made? Because that has a huge impact on the cost of the system. Because obviously the sooner we design the system to arrive, the more ambulances and responders will need to make that possible. So it has a huge economic impact, obviously a big operational impact. It has far-reaching implications throughout the entire system. So it's a pivotal issue. It's an important issue. And it has a big impact clinically. There's certain types of problems where minutes really do matter. And so it's important that we get there in a timely fashion. But that kind of gets us to the crux of the problem, is that a lot of times systems end up picking a target response interval without really giving it a whole lot of thought. It's not at all unusual where systems will have a target response interval because that's the way it's always been. And you talk to the people who work in the system, and they honestly don't remember where that number came from, but it's been that way for a long, long time.
Right.
The other thing you'll see happen is they will look at other communities and what are their target response intervals, and they just try to fit in with the group, but not with any other particular logic involved. And so one of the things that I think is important for people to do is peel the onion, if you will. Why do we need to get there sooner than later? How soon do interventions need to be made when someone calls 911 for assistance? And as you get into that, peeling the onion, if you will, several different things, will come to mind. One is obviously if getting there sooner rather than later makes a difference in the clinical outcome for the patient. Another one might be if the patient is in some sort of situational danger. They might be laying in the middle of the road with a traffic accident, and we want to get there sooner than later so we can keep them from being injured by another passing car,
right,
or the vehicle catching on fire, or anything like that. So there's a number of clinical or operational reasons to get there sooner than later. And even beyond that, there's a patient or customer satisfaction issue to deal with as well. There could be regulatory issues where the state doesn't have to have logic, or the oversight regulatory agency doesn't have to have logic, but they might have just picked 10 minutes with 90% reliability or whatever number they choose for whatever reason. If those are the rules, those are the rules, and you have to comply for it. But in those conversations, usually the most compelling argument is the ones surrounding the impact it would have on patient outcome. And you know, the fact of the matter is that there aren't that many conditions where time is extremely important in how soon we intervene. It's a handful of cases. It's cardiac arrest is probably the most recognized, the archetype, if you will, for extremely time-sensitive emergencies. And other things that, you know, might be considered pre-cardiac arrest situations, a completely obstructed airway, things of that nature. But outside of that, and, you know, a likely couple other sorts of things, there's no science that really demonstrates that a difference of a couple minutes, one way or the other, has a significant impact on outcome. So consequently, a lot of EMS systems have designed themselves in such a way that anytime the 911 phone rings, a lot of systems still respond with lights and sirens to all of those calls, regardless of the apparent acuity or time sensitivity of the situation. That's been changing over the years, but still, there's still a very generalized culture in our industry that if they call 911 and it isn't an obvious non-emergency, we still have a tendency to run hot to most everything. And if you think about it, there probably is a difference in how soon you need to arrive for a cardiac arrest versus someone who stumbled and has injured their leg. And they're talking, they're conscious, they're fine. Yeah, they're in some pain, but, you know, it's not the same sort of scenario.
Right. Usually a broken leg isn't life-threatening.
Correct. So we still have a tendency in systems to treat all emergencies that we respond hot to equally. And so one of the things that I try to help systems with is to kind of wrap their heads around the notion of considering a different response interval for a cardiac arrest than they might even for a heart attack or a stroke, different from an injured leg, different from something you might characterize as chronic care support, that patient who has long-standing diabetes, their caregiver at home is probably not that different medically from the person they're caring for, and they just need us to come out to provide some assistance getting them back into bed, or, you know, with some other situation, and those patients end up being, you know, frequently you know, what we call our frequent flyers, the people we go out to time and time again. So in looking at response times that way, differentiating between those different types of calls with different standards opens up some possibilities. Because we tend to treat them all the same, the science suggests that we probably don't get there fast enough on a cardiac arrest. Their minutes, a minute, has a big impact. Not so much with you know, heart attacks and strokes. There we're looking at, you know, trying to get the blocked vessel reopened within 90 minutes, usually of onset for STEMI, and a little bit longer for stroke. But there's a big difference between 4 minutes and 90 minutes.
Right.
So when we look at response times for EMS systems, they'll frequently have a standard of, say, getting there in 8 minutes, 90% of the time. But it's really important to think about, when does that clock start and when does it stop? Typically, the clock starts when someone calls 911 or when the agency that's responding is notified, and the clock stops when they arrive on scene. But if you think about it clinically, think of a clinical response time. It's from the onset of the problem until the first key intervention is made. So if in the case of the cardiac arrest, we have The person suddenly collapses, and we're assuming a witnessed event here. They collapse, and someone has to hear them fall or, you know, whatever, and go see what's wrong, and then compose themselves sufficiently enough to call 911. So say a minute goes by there.
Right.
Once the call's received at 911, it's typically answered a law enforcement facility is the primary public safety answering point or PSAP, and the call gets transferred, and there's some initial questions asked, and 911, what is your emergency, and all of that sort of stuff. We burned another minute.
Mm-hmm.
So now the pager goes off, the alarm goes off at the station. The crew that's been identified as theoretically closest to the call gets notified, and they've got their, you know, reflex time or shoot time, if you will. Yeah, there goes another minute.
Right, so you're 3 minutes in, even though technically the clock's at zero.
Exactly. So now we've got our 8 minute response time. So now we pull up at the curb. Now we still got to get from the truck to the patient. Now, best scenario, single story residential structure, you know, no locked gates, no mean dogs chasing you through the yard, the doors open, all those sorts of things. At least another minute there. Mm-hmm. So we had 3 minutes beforehand, 8 minutes for transport. We're at 11 minutes, a minute to get to the patient. Now we're 12 minutes. Now I've just touched the patient. Okay, I see somebody's unconscious. I've still got to do my initial assessment and determine if, you know, they have a pulse, are they breathing, all that sort of stuff, you know. And then if I decide they are in cardiac arrest, you know, I can probably start CPR very quickly, but if I am going to defibrillate, I got to charge it up and whatnot. So what we're thinking is an 8 minute response time, you know, is really ends up clinically being closer to 13.
Right.
And if you look at the data, if you're not making that initial key intervention, collapse to defibrillation interval or collapse to initial chest compression interval, within 4 or 5 minutes, you've lost most of the opportunity to resuscitate someone.
Right.
So one of the things that I'm trying to work with systems on is thinking more creatively about how to decrease that collapse to intervention interval. And we have done some things. One thing that we've done that I think is very powerful is emergency medical dispatch, where the dispatcher will coach them on how to do CPR. That's not always happening. I think it will improve now that we don't have the mouth-to-mouth component, particularly if it's not a loved one or at least a close friend.
It's not like in the movies when someone gives CPR to the dog.
So, you know, with all of the, you know, AIDS and communicable disease concerns and whatnot, that's been a huge barrier. So that hopefully will become less of one. But nonetheless, there's still a lot of people who, for whatever reason, don't get chest compressions or ventilations prior to arrival, much less defibrillation. So one of the things that I'm starting to talk to systems more and more about around the country is taking a more creative approach. And one of the things I term witness life support. Some communities have started touching on this where instead of trying to generically train the population in doing CPR, which, you know, is a good thing, but hasn't been particularly effective in most communities, is at least trying to focus on the high-risk populations. If someone in the family has a cardiac history or has had a heart attack, they obviously have a higher likelihood of having a sudden cardiac arrest. Let's focus on them. If geographically we can look at the data and notice that there's certain areas or neighborhoods that have a higher incidence of cardiac arrest, which is probably going to be associated with, you know, age and, you know, retirement communities and those sorts of things, let's focus efforts there. That's one layer. But I think the one of the ones that probably would be of most interest to the listeners of this would be something that I call community life support. Now, cardiac arrest usually represents less than 1% of the calls in the EMS system, and the witnessed onset arrests are even a smaller fraction of that. So what if on those cases we took a much more creative approach and thought about what could we get to the scene sooner than later that maybe isn't an asset or a resource under the direct control of the EMS agency? For example, I bet you if you took your cell phone out of your pocket and looked at it, you would see a little icon on the screen. That's a GIS symbol. Mm-hmm. And basically what it allows the technology to do is pinpoint your location with a reasonable level of accuracy. Now, if we have off-duty personnel and we know where they are because they have allowed us access to their GIS data on their cell phone and they have given us permission to call upon them in these, you know, rare cases,
right,
and we have the GIS data on the location of the call, wouldn't it make sense to potentially, you know, activate off-duty EMS folks, other healthcare workers, mm-hmm, those sorts of things?
Rather than calling 911 first, I push the emergency button on my cell phone, which sends out a ping that says...
Well, no, you would still call 911, but the 911 system would be able to bring up a layer,
sure,
on their computer-aided dispatch screen and
so-and-so off-duty guy is in the same mall.
Yeah, just like you see a layer on the screen that shows where your ambulances are,
right,
on those echo calls, those highly time-sensitive emergencies, we'd see a new map layer show up with community life support resources, which could be off-duty EMS or healthcare personnel. It could be other assets that we typically don't have on our run cards or alarm cards. Staff cars, maintenance vehicles, supply trucks. All we need is somebody to go in and start chest compressions.
Right.
Could it be FedEx trucks and UPS trucks and, you know, power company or cable guys or whatever? All I'm saying is that if we're going to address the issues of cardiac arrest seriously, we're not getting there anywhere close to fast enough to save as many people as we might be able to save. So what I would like people listening to this podcast think about is thinking more creatively about ways we can improve our response interval performance to cardiac arrest. And maybe one of the ways we can afford to do that is if we give ourselves more latitude on some of the other cases where we really don't have to get there that fast, we can back off, mm-hmm, and decrease our utilization of resources on those calls and increase our performance on these more highly time-sensitive emergencies.
Have you noticed I know that there have been a lot more, a move towards getting more AEDs that the public can use, you know, into the, out, you
yeah,
know, at malls, well, and that sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, like fire extinguishers,
yeah,
sure.
I mean, have you seen that is a useful tool also?
And yeah, but again, I think it takes us being more creatively. Mm-hmm. I think there's a tendency to just scatter them around everywhere you can, but that gets pretty expensive.
Right.
I think the return on investment for the amount of money that's spent on AEDs and the number of interventions they actually make,
right,
is really quite low. So just like I talked about with witness life support of being more selective in our focusing where we teach CPR, the same way for focusing where we put the AEDs. Look at your mm-hmm, dispatch data and find out where those hot spots are,
right,
for where the arrests occur and prioritize it there. There's also some software systems available. I've even seen an iPhone app for this. Is in the event you find someone in cardiac arrest, you can register through this iPhone app where AEDs are in your community. You activate the app, and it will tell you where the closest AED is to you. And that's something that, again, if we get more creative with how we think about these things, I think we could be a whole lot more effective in getting the right resources to the right people and in the appropriate amount of time,
mm-hmm,
which in some cases is less time.
Right.
And in some cases, we can take a lot more time and really have no negative impact on clinical outcome.
Is there a danger at all in allowing that? It's very true that, yes, there are calls that don't have to be lights and sirens heading to it. Is there a danger in becoming too lackadaisical and saying, oh, well, It's just a broken leg, or it's just one of our frequent flyers saying she feels ill again today?
Absolutely.
And not treating that with the priority that it may, because it, you know, in any situation can become.
Absolutely. What it comes down to is we have to make choices. And if we know we have cardiac arrests in our community, we know they are extremely time sensitive. We know, based on looking at the clinical response interval I described, we don't get there nearly fast enough. Mm-hmm. Do we deal with the problem we know and try to deal with it more effectively? How do we pay for it? How do we reallocate a finite amount of resources to deal with that problem?
Mm-hmm.
It's always risk.
Right.
No matter where you set that response interval target, a little bit sooner is always better, but it costs a little bit more money. And the cost goes up exponentially as time decreases.
Right.
It's much more expensive to go from 8 minutes to 7 minutes than it is to go from 9 minutes to 8 minutes.
Right.
And so with those sorts of things in mind, you have to look at this at a systems level in the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about an individual call. It's about caring for an entire community. And
right.
How can you best utilize the resources you have available to provide good care to the entire community?
Mm-hmm.
And with that, you have to make some choices. It'd be great if we could have, 3 minute response intervals everywhere in town. That'd be terrific. But we simply can't afford to do that in most communities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any that can get there that fast.
Right.
So given that, we have to make calculated choices. Just like we don't admit everybody to the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chance someone could have an infection. There's a chance someone could have a complication. And it'd be better if they were already in the ICU. Yeah, but at $10,000 a day, that just isn't very very smart to do with finite resources. So it can get to be a very emotional argument, particularly when you're talking about having longer response times,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Jones had that heart attack, and we moved the response interval maybe back from 8 minutes to 12 minutes or whatever, and he arrested, and boy, if
mm-hmm.
EMS would have been there sooner, I'm sure he would be alive and talking. We have to make difficult choices when we design systems.
Right.
And we just try to do the best we can. And so what I'm suggesting here is, in rethinking EMS response intervals, rethink what the underlying issue is. Rethink how we measure the response interval.
Mm-hmm.
Look at it clinically rather than operationally. And rethink how could we get there sooner than later, even if it doesn't involve somebody who's on our payroll, so to speak, and
mm-hmm.
think about community life support rather than just, traditional EMS-delivered basic and advanced life
mm-hmm.
support.
Well, and it seems like also to recognizing that there is, as in anything, especially medically, there is no black and white. So saying, expecting one response interval to apply to everything, it doesn't do you any good to respond to a broken leg in 3 minutes.
But an awful lot of systems do it.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So
should there be an outlier? Should there be absolutely no one should have to wait more than 20 minutes? But
maybe, maybe not.
If it's...
If if we don't think it's an urgent problem, they don't think it's an urgent problem, it may be perfectly okay to wait more than 20 minutes. At a certain point, it becomes more of a customer service issue than
mm-hmm.
a clinical issue. There's certain things that are life-threatening problems but are not particularly time-sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Untreated syphilis will kill you, but it doesn't matter if you get your antibiotics now or tomorrow.
Right.
So we just have to put things in proper context and set priorities accordingly. And yeah, it gets very emotional, and there will be those outlier unusual cases, but you have to be judicious in how you utilize your resources, and that word judicious involves the word judgment,
mm-hmm.
and use the best science available, your best professional judgment, and you make your best call.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm asking people to do is, in rethinking this whole issue of EMS response intervals, let's look at what the science really says about how time-sensitive cases really are. Some of them are more time-sensitive than what our current systems accommodate,
mm-hmm.
like cardiac arrest. And a lot of them we can get there in less time with no clinical compromise.
Yeah. Are you finding that places are open to that idea, or are you running up against resistance to...
Most of the resistance is about change in general. Mm-hmm. That's not the way we've done it. That's not the way our neighbors do it. I've never heard of anybody else doing that before, you know. Therefore, the idea must be bad. Mm-hmm. But if you look at any, you know, significant innovation moving forward, that is always the case. Mm-hmm. And this is no different. This is no different. So, you know, what we each try to do in trying to make our systems better, our profession better, is you know, you pick which windmills you want to tilt at, you know, which wall you want to bang your head against, and hope over time you'll make some progress. And so that's why I wanted to do this podcast with you, is get your listeners thinking about rethinking this whole issue of EMS response intervals, and do they really make sense for our community?
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FISDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.